So tonight, since it is a patriotic night, Air Force One is really important to this country and its history. We thought we would start the evening off with something a little patriotic. Here to sing our national anthem is 12-year-old Oshkosh native Lily Ann. Lily is excited to be back at EA Air Venture for the second year in a row singing the anthem. She was here last year with us for our World War II veterans. She's a singer, songwriter, performed a national anthem throughout Wisconsin for our veterans, the Wisconsin Timber Rattlers, and is starting to perform small venues, showcasing her talent. So without further ado, let's remove our hats. Please stand for Lily singing the national anthem.
Oh, say can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through a perilous fight o'er the ramparts we were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say does that star-spangled banner wave o'er the land of the free and the
That was amazing. So I did not realize that was coming. So tonight we are going to have a great conversation among crews who've actually flown the president, oversaw the command. We have some really, really just wonderful speakers I can't wait for you to see. This is all going to be led by an MC, Jeff Dufert. Jeff Dufert is a senior historian at the Air Force Research Laboratory. He is also the gentleman who led a team to restore and preserve the Memphis Belle at Dayton, Ohio, at the National Museum of the United States Air Force. So you're in good hands with Jeff. He's a wealth of knowledge and a personal friend. I can't wait for y'all to meet him. So let's give a warm EA welcome to Jeff Dufert.
Thanks, buddy. Well, good evening, everyone. The group that we have tonight, we let them know that we're going to have a conversation with these amazing people, with 2,000 of our closest personal friends, so I'm glad you could all come here tonight. Air Force One, what an amazing symbol of freedom and strength and power of our nation around the world, the Flying White House. It means so many things to so many different people. But it really projects the best of what we are. And wherever it goes in the world, it's in essence, it's like a flying embassy. And you see it in the media, it's in our popular culture. There's not just a Hollywood movie called Air Force One that was made about it, but you see it in TV shows like The West Wing. And then you even see it, one of the best-selling shoes in Nike's history is a shoe called Air Force One. And they still make it. I mean, that's incredible. So it's omnipresent. Wherever it shows up, the media's there. It's a backdrop. And then it's also part of our nation's history. Some incredible historical events have taken place on various presidential aircraft over the years. And there's another part of Air Force One as well. There's sort of a secrecy about it. There's a curiosity that we all have. What's really going on in there? It's just generates this interest in it. But when you look at this, the fiction about Air Force One, the reality is that this incredible mission is performed by amazing people, and that is not fiction. The people that lead, the people that perform the mission, the responsibility they have is incredible. Their job is to transport not only the most powerful person in the world, but also important political leaders, sometimes foreign dignitaries, military leaders. What tremendous responsibility that these people have. And they have to perform these duties as perfectly and flawlessly as is humanly possible. And so they have this incredible culture of excellence that's really, it's unique. So you and I are going to get the pleasure to hear some of these amazing people talk tonight and talk amongst themselves. So before we get to that part of the program, we're going to hear a little bit about the history of Air Force One from the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force's historian and from a general who's leading our Transportation Command today. So first, let's bring out Dr. Doug Lantry. He's a historian at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force. He's also a curator there. He's been there for 20 years, worked on major projects. Also, he's a retired reserve officer, and he made three deployments to Southwest Asia to support operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Please help me give a warm welcome to Dr. Doug Lantry.
Well, good evening, everybody. Wow, what a great big crowd and what a great big event. This is my first time at Oshkosh, so I'm bowled over by the whole thing. And I'm especially happy to see all these faces out here. My job in the next 5 minutes is to put a frame, a historical frame, around some of the cultural and technological and operational stories that you're going to hear tonight from people with firsthand personal experience of transporting the chief executive around the country and around the world. So, how do we frame this thing? What is this story about? Well, go back to the early days of aircraft, when aircraft were fragile and unreliable and kind of a gimmick, maybe a toy. Transporting anybody of any importance in an airplane, let alone the President of the United States, was considered unnecessary, dangerous, foolish, and all kinds of other adjectives. It just wasn't thought of as a thing to be done. On top of that, presidents hardly ever left the United States. Why would you? Why would the President of the United States leave the continental U.S.? Well, the first president to leave the continental U.S. on any kind of presidential mission, and the first one to fly in an airplane, was, believe it or not, Teddy Roosevelt, who flew in a Wright B Flyer in 1910. But that was after he was out of office. It was a stunt, and he was sort of an adventurous person. For many decades after that, no president flew in an airplane. It was just unnecessary, and it was kind of dangerous. Until the advent of the Second World War, when American power and the necessity of transporting the chief executive outside the U.S. borders had grown so much that Franklin Roosevelt went to a conference in Casablanca in Morocco in 1943 to plan the invasion of Europe. Air travel had become necessary for the president, and shortly after FDR's first flight in 1944, the Army designated an airplane to be the president's airplane. It was to be called the Flying White House, but that name didn't stick. The journalist's name stuck instead. They called it the Sacred Cow, because for obvious reasons that you can guess. The Sacred Cow, flown by the Brass Hat Squadron, as they called themselves. And so presidential air travel began in earnest. And you'll find throughout this history, which I'll try and compress into a nutshell, as technology grows and American power grows, so does the reach and the speed and the symbolic power of presidential air travel. And so presidents, through President Truman, flew around on propeller-driven aircraft, relatively slow, but increasingly comfortable, with increasing range and increasing capability, increasing comfort, until in 1959, President Eisenhower became the first American president to fly in a jet. Believe it or not, it was a 707 that carried him to Germany to see Konrad Adenauer. That airplane was called Queenie. It was nicknamed Queenie. You can see this airplane now, I think, in Washington State. The most iconic image of a presidential airplane comes slightly afterwards. In October of 1962, a VC-137A, lovingly known by everybody now as SAM 26000, entered service. It was John F. Kennedy's airplane, and its iconic appearance was the product of an industrial designer named Raymond Loewy and also the First Lady, Jacqueline Kennedy. And that image of the blue and white airplane with the presidential seal on it is created in late 1962. Airplanes like that 707, two of them, 26000 and 27000, served for decades and decades and decades, and saw all kinds of important and interesting travel. Tragic travel, of course. In November of 63, SAM 26000 brought the president's body back from Texas after he was assassinated. But it also took Richard Nixon to China and to the Soviet Union to negotiate arms control agreements. And technology and culture and symbolism had progressed to the point of making Air Force One a mobile flying symbol of American prestige and power. Kennedy especially had encouraged the press to meet the airplane at every landing and encouraged them to use the name Air Force One. And so it became symbolic of the president, his administration, and American policy and power, both at home and abroad. In 1990, a new airplane joined the fleet, VC-25A, the 747 with that same livery as the original 707s. So that iconography is carried forward in this enormous new airplane that is serving today. It will serve for some years to come. And as I said at the beginning, my job in the conversation you'll hear tonight is to kind of put a preservation spin or a historical frame around all these things. But that's all kind of off to the side, because what you get tonight is the first-hand views of people who actually did these jobs and had these personal experiences of Air Force One and transporting presidents. So I'm gonna get out of the way and let this conversation begin. And hopefully you have a little historical frame to work with, and let's hear about these personal experiences now. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lantry. So our next guest here tonight, I was gonna talk about this long list of achievements that she has, and I assure you she does. But she came up to me just before the presentation and said, "You're not doing a long introduction, are you?" And I said, "Well, I was going to do a medium introduction." And she felt that a short introduction was better. So I'm gonna listen to the general. But I assure you, she has a long list of some amazing achievements and service to our country. General Van Ovost, Jacqueline Van Ovost, was the commander of the 89th Airlift Wing from 2010 to 2012. So she surely was there and done that. Today, she is the commander of the U.S. Transportation Command, and that's strategic transport and mobility for our DOD and for our nation, air, land, and sea. So please join me in a warm welcome to General Jacqueline Van Ovost.
All right. Wow, ending a beautiful day here at Oshkosh. Thanks for participating in this today. Thanks to Doug and Jeff for setting up this time here for we can learn a little bit more about Air Force One. But I want to roll you back just a little bit. The 89th Airlift Wing, the President's Wing, is at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C. I was the commander of the President's Wing. And in that wing, we have about 700 people, and we had 17 airplanes. And so, wait a minute, all you see is the beautiful Boeing 747. But what we actually ran, the majority of the wing, was managing these 17 airplanes. We had Gulfstream 500s, Gulfstream 550s, 737s, and 757s. I flew the 757. And we were responsible for the rest of the, what we call the top five. The top five is the president, the vice president, secretary of state, secretary of defense, the first lady, and then we begin with the chairman of joint chiefs and the service chiefs and down the line for our service military personnel that fly those aircraft. But on top of that, we supported 535 congressmen and senators. So let's just say that demand was greater than capacity, because they like to fly those airplanes. But it's amazing. So I flew Air Force Two, which is the Vice President, then Vice President Biden, and the Secretary of State, then Secretary of State Clinton. And what I really learned about this is that the 89th Airlift Wing flying everybody other than the President is the breeding ground for our Air Force One pilots, for our Air Force One engineers, maintainers, and our flight attendants. So to become a member of the 89th Airlift Wing and fly the other beautiful blue and white airplanes, you had a strict interview process, and that's both pilots and flight attendants. And once you got through the interview process, you started to fly these airplanes. You were selected to fly for a couple of years. And during that time, the team over at Air Force One, where the Air Force One team will come talk to you about how they selected from there, they were watching these pilots and flight attendants looking for tactical excellence and a poise, you know, strategic thinking. So you're essentially in the interview process for a couple of years if you want to go be an Air Force One pilot. So notice I said that nobody on the other side of this the fence, I'll call it the Air Force One fence, flew 747s. The 747s were strictly for the president. Now, DB Airlift is like about most things. It's all about logistics. That's my current job now. It's all about logistics. It's about planning, right? But it's not just, if you might fly corporate, it's not flying, it's not just a flight plan. It's working diplomatically, you know, across overseas. It's looking at maintenance, the maintenance requirements, making sure you have everything you need, you know, stair trucks, all the support that you need forward, understanding where you're going to taxi the airplane, where you're going to pull off, where's the red carpet going to be, where's the show going to occur. And then we have to marry it up with other support equipment that may have to fly in. You may need air stairs. If you're flying the president, you will need the Beast, Cadillac One. We fly Cadillac One out there to be with him. It's an armored vehicle along with other armored assets. And if you fly overseas, we fly the Mini Marine One, put that in the back of a cargo aircraft and fly it out to meet. So there's a lot of orchestrations of events to make this, to make each event overseas perfect. Why is that? Why do you need to be perfect? And our motto is perfection is the standard. And Doug and Jeff talked a little bit about this, but this is about delivering American diplomacy, right? American diplomacy around the world, being there to talk national security issues, sign international agreements, sign economic agreements, you know, move forward the agenda of America. That's why every step was so important. When the DV steps off the airplane, they have strict objectives they need to get after. Right? And there's a timetable. You need to meet that timetable. And when that DV gets off the airplane, the last thing you want is for cameras rolling to see something go wrong. The air stairs truck gets a flat tire, doesn't make it there, right? Or something's wrong with the airplane, something's leaking out, at the brake area, right? They're watching that. That becomes the story, right? That's a fail. A win is all they see is that DV going down, and they get in some Cadillac and off they go, right? A fail is if the press is looking at something other than that. So there's a lot of orchestration to be done there. As we mentioned earlier, these are flying command centers. You become personal staff for these DVs when they get on the airplane. They need to rest. They need to hydrate. They need to have nutrition. They need to have access to news because news changed their speeches, which they're furiously writing and printing, right? They're making phone calls. They're on video teleconferences. They need all the information before they get off that jet. And you as a team work together to get that information to them. So as I said, this is a no-fail mission for our nation. Every detail very carefully orchestrated. But I also want to say that this is one of the amazing, amazing missions that we do in your United States Air Force. In United States Air Force, we have 5 missions. Air superiority. Think fighters. Global strike. Think bombers. Intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance aircraft and capabilities. Command and control capabilities. And rapid global mobility. And DV airlift is part of our rapid global mobility mission set, for which I am now responsible as the commander of United States Transportation Command. There are many things you can do in the Air Force to support the amazing Air Force One team, from, again, logistics, flight attendant, maintenance, air traffic control. And there are many missions you can do in the Air Force, all of which thrive with airmen who are breaking technological and cultural barriers to get after the mission at hand, to deliver air power anytime, anywhere. And there is no greater symbol of air power than that beautiful blue and white airplane when it pulls up on a tarmac in some foreign nation to make a statement for America. Thanks.
Excellent. Thank you, General. So I'd like to introduce the remainder of our guests for tonight, and U.S. Navy Captain Skip Lucier. And I did say U.S. Navy, so he's got a great story to tell us tonight. And finally, Air Force Colonel Mark Tillman, and he was the Presidential Aircraft Commander from 2001 to 2009. Boy, what a treat. Isn't this wonderful? So what I'd like to start with, now, we think about flying the president, flying the airplane, but there was a group that was involved with presidential flight and with special air mission that had this really intimate interaction with the president and other dignitaries. And I'd like to have Chuck Heppner tell us about being a flight steward on Air Force Two and back up on Air Force One. Also, too, he's the person who goes the farthest back with the special air mission going back to the 1970s. We'd love to hear what you had to say, Chuck.
Thank you. This is a wonderful bunch. A bunch of people want to hear old crew dogs start war stories. I got to Andrews in 1972. I'd been a tanker crew chief up in Plattsburgh, New York. B-58s before that, but an opportunity came up. I had met somebody who was the chief of maintenance, and I was able to get an assignment. It took almost a year, and then I became a flight steward, and my first assignment was with Vice President Agnew. That didn't last long. then I switched. I had done some flying with the House Minority Leader, a guy by the name of Jerry Ford. So when he became the first non-elected Vice President of the United States, I was put on his crew as his lead because of our previous relationship. Flying a vice president especially that year with all the turmoil going on in D.C., was a daily business. I was flying the Boeings, the VC-135 and the VC-137. I had my counterparts were flying on the Convairs and the little Jetstars. And between us, we would arrange who's flying. He's flying this airplane, he's going to Johnstown, or he's flying this airplane going to California. But that year, President Ford was just constantly on the go. And then, of course, he upgraded. Flying the big trips as an Air Force II flight steward, or what we commonly and affectionately called hot cuppers, I'd fly on the big trips on the backup airplane, and that was the best job in the world. The back galley on 6000 was just no pressure. You had staff, you had the off-detail, off-scheduled Secret Service agents. Everything was relaxed. And then we supplemented the primary airplane. If they needed a pound of butter, we'd get to the next stop and we'd send it over from our stocks. But you plan these missions sometimes weeks in advance. Colonel Donnelly and Colonel Tillman would get it from the White House, their staff would go into it, and then the flight stewards would start getting involved once there was an itinerary. Once the itinerary of where we're going, when we're going, how many people are going, was established, then we would start creating the menu based on what time we're taking off, what time we're landing. Is the president or the vice president going to a state dinner on arrival? And those were the training things. And when I finally retired, I was the chief of training for the entire flight attendant program. And I still maintain my Air Force II and flying, well, for those days, it was the Reagan administration. But just a tremendous career, 16 years of a lot of memories. I still stay in touch with the majority of my crew members, front and back. It was just a wonder. But the first day I stepped on board Air Force One on the primary airplane, I stepped inside that galley door and said, I'm on Air Force One. And it was like, wow. And over the years, everybody else I've talked to had pretty much the same feeling, that first operational mission they flew. Good job, a lot of fun, a lot of hours.
So Chuck, you know, I was thinking you had this intimate relationship with those who were on board. What, can you recall maybe the strangest request or oddest request you had in those years?
You know, I got to ask that question last night by Hal, and there was a congressman from Illinois at the time, and he became Secretary of Defense for President Nixon. And he was on the go a lot. And he was going to this state dinner, he was going to that state dinner, he was going to that state dinner, and having a large meal on board the airplane was more than he could handle. So while everybody else is having prime rib, he loved cold sliced meatloaf and ketchup sandwiches on whole wheat with a cup of tomato soup. So when we were on a big trip with him, we made sure that we had 5 or 6 pounds of cooked off meatloaf, all sliced, ready to go. Birthday cakes for the Vice President, Vice President Ford on his 61st birthday. We made homemade peach ice cream in the back of the airplane because Mrs. Ford liked it. Things like that. If we couldn't cook it, we wouldn't use it, but probably lamb chops is the worst meal I ever had to fix. Mm-hmm. Grilled lamb chops stunk up that airplane, and I'm quite sure you guys smelled it as well.
So about the time that Master Sergeant Heppner finished with the 89th in 1988, so then Colonel Donnelly came to the 89th Airlift Wing, and then in 1997 became the aircraft commander of the presidential flight. Colonel, can you tell us about your experiences?
Well, Dr. Lantry talked about the airplanes of Air Force One, but in 1944, there was also the first guy that was named presidential pilot. Since then, there have been 16 presidents and 17 presidential pilots. So the current pilot is now the 17th guy since 1944. No, I was listening to Chuck talking about his crew member experiences, and it reminded me how easy my job got to be when I was out on the road. We would stop, and there would be a flurry of activity. The president would leave, and he might be back in 45 minutes or 6 hours. There'd be a flurry of activity as we readied the airplane for the next leg of the trip. And my job was to sit somewhere where crew members could find me, because they were all so professional and so good at their jobs that they didn't need my help unless some major obstacle came up. So my job was to sit someplace and read my paperback while they did all the work around me, including the other pilots on the airplane. The job of the presidential pilot is not only flying the president around, but he's also the commander of the presidential airlift group at this point. And that means hiring maintenance people as well as air crew, maintenance on the aircraft, and the programs that develop new Air Force Ones and upgrade the current fleet. So that was the challenge of the job that I had. The easy part was going out on the road with the president.
So could you tell us about, do you have any notable experiences or events, funny moments, or?
Yeah, you know, these guys have a couple epic tales of events that they performed, but I don't have that. I have a lot of like snapshots. And one of my favorite was President Hussein of Jordan would come to the United States for medical treatment occasionally. And we were going to a Mideast summit in Egypt, and President Clinton invited King Hussein along. I was the co-pilot on this trip. And King Hussein drove up, a couple limos drove up, and he climbed on board, and next we get a panicked phone call up in the cockpit saying, he's coming up the stairs, he's coming up to the cockpit. Well, sure enough, the king came up to the cockpit, sat down in the jump seat, straps himself in. Wow. That's unusual. And then the president came up, and I don't remember if he came up in a motorcade or in the helicopters, but the king was looking out the windows just like we did from upstairs and watched the president do his thing down there with the wing commander and get on board the airplane. And so we figured, okay, show's over, king's gonna leave. But no, we started engines, taxied out, took off, climbed on up to our cruise altitude, and he leveled off, and the king said, well, I guess I should go down and say hello to the president.
Thank you, Brad.
That was pretty impressive.
I guess it's good to be the king.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly what he said to Colonel Barr, who's the pilot on that leg.
So many of you are probably aware that the Air Force is not the only service that has flown the president before. So the Army and the Marines actually did presidential airlift with a rotary wing with helicopters until about the 70s, and then that became strictly a Marine mission. Now, unfortunately, Dick Collada couldn't make it with us tonight. He was going to come, so we wish him well if he's watching tonight. But I'm sure you heard me say that I introduced a Navy captain. And Skip Lucier is going to tell us about the long storied history of Navy One. I think it lasted at least an hour.
16 minutes.
Okay. So he has an amazing story to tell me about the lone flight of Navy One.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, I can assure you that my path to flying the president was very different than the distinguished Air Force pilots who were next to me. I was a classic case of being in the right place, the right time, and fitting the right suit. My story begins when we were flying the S-3 Viking. 19 years ago, I had the privilege of flying President George W. Bush aboard the Abraham Lincoln. The intent was to give a speech to welcome the crew back after an extended deployment, the longest one of a nuclear carrier up to that point, and also to announce the end of major combat operations in Iraq. The airplane was the S-3 Viking. That airplane had flown for the Navy and the nation for about 35 years, mostly an unsung hero, relative anonymity. Nobody knew what an S-3 was. I was very happy that the flight of Navy One brought a spotlight to the community, because there are thousands of Americans, men and women, that were flying and maintaining that plane. So I've dedicated my comments to them tonight, and also importantly remember the 54 aviators that lost their lives while flying it, especially the crew of Blue Wolf 704. Next slide. So first of May 2003, the aircraft carrier was the Abraham Lincoln. There were a couple squadrons involved. VS-35 Blue Wolves was my squadron. I was the executive officer, second in command at the time. And also the VS-41 Shamrocks were our sister squadron. They were on the beach. They captured our airplanes after we came off deployment, turned them around, manned the spare aircraft, and basically made the flight happen. We were flight of two. So in my airplane was myself, President Bush, Eddie, you got to pronounce the last name for me?
Marenzel.
Marenzel, I apologize. A Secret Service agent, I just called him Eddie. He was in the back seat along with Lieutenant Ryan Wilson Phillips. So that was our Navy One aircraft. And the other aircraft had one of our best pilots, Lieutenant Rocky Baker, and it had Andrew Card, the Chief of Staff from the White House. Lieutenant Commander Scott Z-Man Zellum was the Naval Flight Officer for my squadron. And then there was Lieutenant Commander Huff Huffington, who was the military aide to the President that carried the football. So the S-3, you know, like I said, flew for about 35 years. You could have a crew of two or four. We flew with four on both of these missions. The airplane was originally designed as a sub hunter, but it turned out that towards later in life, we did a lot of armed surface recce, and importantly, in-flight refueling, which was a key enabler to carrier operations. The squadron was about 220 strong, and without those hardworking Americans, those 8 30-year-old airplanes wouldn't fly, and I'll talk a little bit about their performance during Iraqi freedom here in a minute. So the story actually starts when the Abraham Lincoln Strike Group deploys in July 2002. It was supposed to be a 6-month deployment, it turned into 10. We got turned around on New Year's Day. We got sent to Australia to resurface the flight deck, reprovision the ship. We didn't know when we were coming home, but we went back to the Persian Gulf. And then on the 19th of March, when Saddam Hussein and his sons failed to heed the ultimatum of President Bush and the coalition, we started conducting combat operations in Operation Iraqi Freedom. We flew combat operations for about 3 weeks until the fall of Baghdad. And then at the end of that period of time, combat strikes were pretty much over. And since we had been there the longest, we were going to be the first ones to be released. So we were going back across the Pacific about as fast as the carrier could go. We pulled the rods and off we went. Little did I know, back in D.C., there was a plan to have a speech on board the carrier to talk about thanking the crew and announcing the end of combat operations. My understanding is the story for choosing an airplane goes something like this. They're sitting around the table and they say, hey, where's the ship going to be? Oh, it's 150 miles offshore. Well, Marine One can't fly that far. The SOP for Marine One is 50 nautical miles. So how do we get them out there? Navy goes, put them in a Super Hornet. All right? So. And the Secret Service says, absolutely not. We got to have 24/7 visit the man. There's no way that this is going to happen. Well, it just so happens that Vice President Cheney, when he was Secretary of Defense, had flown out to a carrier in an S-3. And the other serendipitous fact was the White House military officer, a Navy O-6, was Captain Mike Madman Miller, an S-3 pilot. So Dick looks at Mike and says, hey, do you think he can fly out in an S-3? Why, sure he can. And that's how the airplane was chosen. So there was a lot of envy around Naval Air about which airplane got to fly the president. Again, the pilot selection was a little different. So we pull into Hawaii, and the fleet commander comes out to thank us, and he says, hey, I got a great news for you. The president's coming out to your ship. He's going to give a speech, and he's going to fly in one of your airplanes, an S-3. And I looked at my CO, Greg Looney Tunes, and I said, Tunes, did you know about this? And he goes, absolutely not. And then somebody says, I wonder who the pilot is. And I said, well, he's got two thumbs, and it's this guy. Because I was the senior 05, you know, Navy S-3 pilot on board the Lincoln. And that was the criteria that came down. There was no selection. There was no interview. It was, I want a Navy 05 that was in the war on the Lincoln that flew the S-3. And that's how I got to be the pilot. Well, one of the things that the Navy likes to do is, you know, knee-jerk reactions. Oh, my gosh. You know, we can't let this man who hasn't seen his wife in 10 months go home and fly the leader of the free world out to the carrier. He needs to come back to San Diego, like right now. Now, so I call my wife up and I said, hey, honey, can you come pick me up at San Diego International about 5 hours? She goes, you got fired, didn't you? I said, no, it's okay. I said, I can't tell you on this line. I'll tell you when I land. So I land in San Diego and she's like, what in the world? I said, you can't tell anybody. I'm flying Bush out to the ship on Thursday. The worst kept secret in San Diego for the next 3 days. Okay. The next few days were a whirlwind of me finding out about how important the protocol, the advanced teams, the intricacy of flying the president go. But one of the things that they were very strict about was the timeline. And I kept saying, look, this is not your normal travel stop. This is unique. He's going to fly in an ejection seat airplane for the first time in 30 years. I need a crew brief. Well, what's a crew brief? You know, well, I need to talk. And so they kept saying, well, you get 5 minutes. And I said, we usually brief for an hour. All right, 10. And finally got it to 25 minutes. So we got a 25-minute wedge in the schedule so that we could have a crew brief with the president. What ends up happening is on Thursday, the 1st of May, the Air Force One lands, and people ask me, well, were you nervous? And when he got off on the air stairs and he waves his hand, Wilson hits me in the side and goes, well, XO, there's no backing out now. You know? I can tell you, I felt a lot of butterflies at that moment. President comes in the base ops building, gets into his flight suit. First thing he says, where's my pilot? And he comes over and shakes my hand, and then we put him into an ejection seat simulator so that he gets familiar with how to egress the airplane. And then we get to sit down for about 25 minutes of non-attribution, probably the only non-attribution he had during his presidency. It was like being with old flight school buddies, I'll be honest with you. So we start talking, and we start talking about the flight and the mission, explaining how to work the radios. And we get to the point of talking about emergencies. And I said, you know, Mr. President, 99.9% of the time, everything goes really smoothly in naval air. But there's always that 0.01% chance. He goes, Luce, you don't need to worry about that. We got a great vice president. I said, well, if you're not worried, I'm not worried. I said, but if we have to get out of the airplane and you pull your ejection handle or I pull mine, we're going to be out of the jet in 4 seconds and swinging in our chutes in 5. And he goes, yeah, 6. So I'm just like, the president's we wrap up the brief and we walk out to the airplane and we hot switch him with the crew. And the president gets in and we start taxiing as a flight of 2. And I guess easiest taxi clearance I've ever had. You know, it's like a Navy 1 taxi, flight of 2, you're cleared all the way. So we taxi out and we take off. Now we're taking off as a section, and there's about a 4-second interval between the two airplanes. As we're running down the runway, things start going a little wonky. S3 is a little old. My number one generator starts cycling off and on. Okay, and what happens when that, the number one bus that controls a lot of the electronics starts acting up. So the first thing I notice is the president's artificial horizon's tumbling in a big circle. He's a pilot, he knows something's not right. The other thing I notice is that the microphone on his helmet had a jack and it had come loose, so he's Nordo, he can't hear. And then when I rotate the aircraft, I go to raise the landing gear and it's controlled by the number one bus and the gear doesn't come up. I'm like, you know, people aren't gonna understand me turning downwind at this point. So I just like, okay, off comes the number one generator, up comes the auxiliary power unit, flipping his attitude source to mine, and then I'm reaching across the cockpit to put the plug in, and my dash 2 is clean, and he's coming up on me fast. And so Rocky yells on the radio, so he goes, gear! And so I go, override, and I put the landing gear override up, and I said, they come up, and I'm like, oh, thank goodness. Now I hope they come down when we go to the ship. We level off at about 6,000 feet, and one of the things that the Secret Service absolutely says, you will maintain positive control of that airplane the whole time. You will not let the president fly. Mr. President, you want to fly? Why, sure I do. So he takes control of the airplane, and the first thing he says to Eddie, the Secret Service agent, is, all right, Eddie, I got the controls. Don't get nervous. Shakes the airplane around real violently. Said, all right, Eddie, I'm a little off altitude. Bumps the nose over. We all go light in our seats. He yanked that guy's chain all the way out to the ship. So the plan is for us to land second. So we end up doing a lead change, and now we're flying formation. So I'm teaching the president how to fly formation on the other airplane. Then I take control, and we go by the ship and do a flyby. There are more people on the flight deck than I've ever seen in my life. We come around into the break, and I think we got a video that we're going to try to do if it works. Doesn't look like it's working. So we come into the break, and Rocky's got the lead. Now, Rocky is a really good pilot, and he does what we call the Sierra Hotel break, which means he brakes before the back end of the ship. And that's pretty aggressive. And by the time that I extended, I was already over the island of the ship, was still pretty aggressive. I said, well, thanks a lot. Give me a little love here. You know, extend the pattern out for me. We were trying to make sure that there was no issue between the two airplanes and have double interval separation, because usually we land about every 45 seconds. We extended that a little bit. So Rocky lands, catches the three wire with Andrew Card in the airplane, pulls out, and then I come in and I catch the four wire. Now, any wire was good that day, I can tell you right now. The landing signal officer still gave me an okay pass, but I caught a lot of grief from all my naval aviation buddies because the three is the preferred wire. But again, we stopped, and thank goodness, because I probably would not be here if we had not stopped.
You might mention you just caught grief from Colonel Tillman tonight.
Yeah, he the first thing he mentioned when he saw me tonight. You caught the four wire, didn't you? Yeah. So what happens when we land on the deck is we turn around the angle, and we come down, and we park the airplane. And at that point, the protocol people said, hey, make sure you tell the president to take the flight gear off. And I said, hey, Mr. President, they want you to take the gear off. He goes, I feel pretty good now. I think we'll keep it on. So he gets out of the airplane, full flight gear regalia. And we get out in front of the jet, and Wilson and I are just supposed to kind of stay off in the background. You know, this is the president's moment to wave to the press. He's a very caring and generous guy. He calls us over. We stand in front of the airplane. That's where I get my best picture ever of shaking hands with the president. And he goes to shake my hand and he goes, son, you're on national television.
Yep.
And then probably one of the more remarkable things is, you know, whenever you come aboard a Navy ship, you get bonged aboard. So they bong the president aboard, and it's ding, 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 eight bells, United States arriving. And I mean, I got a body rush just from the chills I had on the president aboard. I can't tell you what it meant to the crew. It was so exciting. We were all excited to go back home. When they found the president was coming, they said, oh, let's stay out. You know, I said, oh, can I paint something? So they started repainting everything to make the ship look good. The XO had to come on the 1MC and say, there will be no more painting on Abraham Lincoln, because it just smelled like, you know, Sherman Williams factory after a while. So the president goes through some honorary side boys. He meets the leadership. And then he was supposed to be on the flight deck for about 5 minutes. He ends up being on flight deck for about 45 minutes. I heard them say, there will be no cameras on the flight deck of the Abraham Lincoln. Everybody had a camera. And he starts taking pictures with them. And I think the Secret Service agents just kind of gave up after a while, because he was mugging with every flight deck person, every yellow shirt, brown shirt, red shirt, yellow shirt, purple shirt. They loved it. And they all kept those pictures by their sides for the rest of their careers on board the ships or the squadrons. And it was a great morale booster. So at the end of this day, we flew off, and the president gave a speech, and the speech was very successful. He ended up spending the night on the ship, and he worked out, and he was in his sweaty gear, and he went through every maintenance control and shook the hands of all the crew, and you'll see pictures there of just him walking around. And I tell you, it was a remarkable moment. The other thing he wanted to make sure he was out of the way before the ship pulled in the next morning. So he flew off the next morning early on Marine One and got out on Air Force One before the ship pulled into port. So I can tell you that there was a lot of firsts there, but you know, we had a Bush doll that was created, so you can get an action figure for a Bush doll. There was a painting that was made, and the other thing, I was also the moment of Zen on Jon Stewart. So if you've ever seen the old Jon Stewart show, you know, so I got a call, man, you were the moment of Zen. I was like, oh. So the two things that I remember the most about it, you never had to tell what an S3 was for a while. I didn't have to explain the airplane I flew, which was great. And my mom got a standing ovation at the Maggie Valley Senior Citizens Bingo. So if you can be 40 years old and get a standing O for your mom, things are going pretty well for you.
That's great. Thank you. And Colonel Tillman, we'd love to hear your experiences.
No, absolutely. But let me tag on to the Navy One story, though, okay? So Air Force One, the big 747, pulls in. And we look out, and there are literally no more than four S3s that have been painted with President Bush's picture or name on the side. There were three backups just for the one that we had there. So, but the best part was the next morning we picked him up with the Prime Minister from Australia. We're flying back to Crawford, Texas, and on the way back over Midland, the President comes to the cockpit and he brings the Prime Minister up, and he wants to show him Midland, and we're talking with him. So I asked the president, what was it like flying, you know, Navy One and landing on the carrier? And he said, you know, he was so proud of the United States Navy and everything he saw and did. It was just so impressive. And then the co-pilot, we called him Triple X goes, Mr. President, which wire did you hit? And the president goes, they told me it was a four wire. And he goes, oh, good. That was great luck then. And the president goes, what do you mean? There's only four wires, Mr. President. So So he just starts laughing and everything, and then he goes, "Hey, Tillman, forget about it, all right? I'm flying a 747 with three autopilots." So he leans over, hits me in the chest, and goes, "Yeah, it's got to be really tough flying with three autopilots here." That guy actually crashed into the carrier. It was really neat. So that being said, my son's a growler pilot in the United States Navy, so I'm very proud of the United States Navy. Hoorah. You did great. You did great. September 11th was a big day for all of us, and I had the advantage point of, as Mark, I got to work under Mark Donnelly as his deputy, and I learned a lot from him, and in September 11th, all that came out. It was, we've always had a vantage point of history from the cockpit, and this was a day that we got a chance to see the United States come together, all the military forces, as well as all the different operations within the United States of America. Challenging day for all of us. A lot of things went wrong, communication failed. There was a lot of challenges with moving the president around the country and keeping him safe. But for the most part, President Bush just did an amazing job, and so did all the leaders around the country. We literally had all the information President Bush was getting on a speaker to us in the cockpit so that we had situational awareness of everything that was about to occur. He was getting more information than you could possibly think of. He was talking with the folks in New York. He was talking with the folks in Pennsylvania. He was talking with the command and control all around the world. We were getting information from not only our country, but from countries all over the world. One of the challenges, which never even thought of, Secretary Rice and some of the others let the Russians know and others that, you know, our country's coming up to its highest level of defense at this point. You need to know what we are doing. And we just started making all kinds of communication calls from Air Force One. It was a long day, and the biggest thing I learned from it is watching President Bush in action and watching all the leadership in the United States Air Force, Transcom, and all the others come together and provide a plan of attack for Air Force One to bring the president home. And it was just incredible how the services came together. Now, the other part of it was, in months and years later, it was just so neat to watch the United States of America come together. Every location we came to, everybody was chanting USA, USA, no matter where we went. Didn't matter whether you're Republican, a Democrat, ethnicity, anything, you are Americans. And everybody was out at the side of the plane or every event the president went to. Give you a quick example, Cedar Rapids. We pull in, there's a little kid with a sign. It says, "Put me in, coach." When the president gets off, he sees the little guy and he walks over and he starts talking to the crowd. And then the little guy, you know, when everybody leaves and the president goes into the city, the little guy comes walking across the ramp with the sign. He ends up talking to our top cop and he said, "Hey, the president said I could take a tour of Air Force One." And we all know President Bush didn't say that, but it was so neat, so neat. He's probably a Fortune 500 company CEO today or something. But they asked the question, we said, "Of course, you know, you can have a tour, young man." And all of a sudden he yells behind him, "They said we could have a tour!" And 40 of the finest T-ball families came out. We gave them tours all day long. But that was what America was about, and America stood strong. And to me, that day, and from then on, the United States of America, you know, we were let down, but we came back, and we're coming back day after day after day. Very proud of the United States of America and the United States military.
Colonel Tillman, with the president being in the air, did the leadership feel that was the safest place for him to be? I mean, the best place for him to be was in the air, and could you tell a little bit about, you know, what your flight envelope was, you know, what altitude you were flying at, where you went to?
One of the challenges leaving Florida was the FAA had told us there was a plane overhead descending into us, that was, they assumed we were the target. So when we took off, the goal was to outmaneuver that plane, fighter support was coming in, and then we were gonna get as high as we could. The airliners usually don't go into the high 40s, so we're going to go into the high 40s and get him back to Washington, D.C. Kind of the funny part was our job was to relocate the president But the president, when he found out about it, countermanded the orders and said there'd be no way he's going to hunker down, which to this day I laugh. The order should have an asterisk at the top, and it should say, is your president from the state of Texas? If so, jump to the bottom, because he's not going to follow. So President Bush countermanded and said, no, we're heading back to Washington, D.C. So we started heading that way until there were obvious, there became more and more information given to him. There was still one airliner that had not so-called met its target. Fighters were moving in on it, and that's the aircraft that eventually went down over Shanksville. So it was just keeping them airborne at that point, turning away from Washington, D.C. was a decision that he made, and we worked that through him. Just to keep them airborne was kind of the safest way possible. And then move them around. Then eventually he had to address the American public, so that's why we landed at Barksdale Air Force Base. He addressed the American public. There were still kind of incidents going on back in the Washington, D.C. area, so the plan was to move them to another secure location, put them deep underground at Offutt Air Force Base, and then move them back to Washington, D.C. The president was ready to go back to Washington right from the start, and he finally at Offutt just said, I've had enough, we're heading home. And that's what we did. We screamed home from Offutt Air Force Base.
That's, I mean, some remarkable flexibility to be able to just turn on a dime like that. So, but it was, that's what you guys do, right?
No, that was, I mean, you picked the best of the best from the 89th Airlift Wing in the United States Air Force.
So that's amazing.
Everybody was motivated and ready to make things happen.
Yeah, so I understand you took the president to throw a pitch out in Yankee Stadium. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, he you know, if you can watch on television, his first pitch, I think it was in Milwaukee, where he threw it and hit the bounce before home plate. And so the next pitch, his plan was after September 11th, he was going to throw out the first pitch in Yankee Stadium in the World Series. So the Yankees are playing the Arizona Diamondbacks. Game 3 of the World Series was going to be in New York. So the plan was he'd throw out the first pitch, but he had to wear basically a bulletproof vest and throw that pitch out. So as we're flying towards New York, he's on the jet, all dressed up, just lobbing the ball back and forth with the staff to make sure everything's perfect. It was the neatest thing ever, because he's so motivated and wanted to make sure everything was perfect. And sure enough, when he threw the first pitch, it was a perfect strike. But the moment he did it, and he starts moving back, and he's talking with the managers, it's literally the whole crowd starts erupting into USA, USA. Coolest thing ever. So proud to have got him there, and he threw a perfect pitch. That was all. That's all I needed to see.
That's great. Well, so I'd like to kind of ask the group, are there any of you who still keep in touch with former presidents or with former leaders?
I got a Christmas card for about 3 years before we moved overseas, and I think that was the most disappointing thing for my wife, was not longer to get a White House Christmas card. Yeah. That was about as close as I got.
Yeah, that'd be special. So I'd also like to ask Sergeant Heppner. So you mentioned there was a term, hot cuppers.
Yes.
How did that come about?
Well, it's a piece of aircraft equipment. If anybody ever been to a Woolworths sandwich shop counter where you order a soup and they put it in the stainless steel cup and they puts it in a holder and it turns on the timer, that's a hot cup. And each airplane had three of those: gravy, soup, sauces, hot chocolate, whatever we wanted to heat up and serve. So way back a long time ago, some cute flight engineer said, well, you guys operate the hot cup, so you're hot cuppers. And over the years, it's kind of died out right now with the current people, the current active duty, but when we flew the big trips, the person running the trip was called the first cup. And then you had the second cup, third cup, fourth, all the way down to the sixth. And it was kind of a pleasant nickname, but it was like, well, you guys operate the hot cup, so therefore, you know, radios were called sparks. Engineers were called a lot of things. But that's where it came from. It's kind of died out, but running the Heritage program at Andrews right now, we're trying to get it reinvented, and maybe in the reunion this fall we can get it going. But if you ever get to Dayton and you go on board Columbine 3, you'll see three of them in the front wall of the galley, and they don't do them anymore. Maybe people at command decided to not spend the money.
Probably.
Oh, yeah, full gallons.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another story.
It's called a microwave.
So Chuck made a good point talking about the presidential aircraft at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force. There are about 8 presidential aircraft there. Many of the airframes that these folks talked about tonight are actually there. Also, there were 2 presidential helicopters, and one of those 2 are there on display. And then I understand that the S-3B that you flew is also in a museum.
It's the Naval Aviation Museum in Pensacola.
Yeah, so you can see these things up close. I think it's pretty amazing to hear about this history and then to see these artifacts. No matter how much time goes by, it doesn't change the fact that those aircraft were there and were part of our history. So, I'm sure we've heard about a few special moments. Oh, I'm sorry, Chuck.
Well, one point I want to put up right now is the special air mission, Sam Fox people, we have the largest number of airframes in museums throughout the country than any other flying organization. Whether it's Tucson, Seattle, Dover, right, Pat? We have the largest collection of all the C-9s, most of the 118s, everything like that. So they're over there, and they're nice airplanes to go through.
Yeah, so Chuck, you mentioned Sam Fox. Would you be able to tell the audience where that name comes from? It's certainly a term of great pride, no doubt.
Well, back in the days of the brass hats out of Washington National, there were 2 organizations. You had the domestic and the foreign. And it became, soon after, there was a guy by the name of C.R. Meyer, or C.R. Smith. And he had come from American Airlines and a general by the name of George. And they knew that with World War II coming along, there was going to have to be a VIP outfit, which became the brass hats at Washington National Airport. So they called it Special Air Missions. And in May of 1943, mm-hmm. we were formally recognized as the VIP outfit. And then you had foreign, which is Foxtrot, and then you had domestic, which was Delta. So you had Sam Delta for the C-47s and the C-45s and the up to New Yorks or the down to Floridas or whatever. And then you had the Sam Foxtrot for, at the time, was a C-87 and the C-54s, and then up into the Connies. And then after a while, it just kind of got dropped. But Sam Fox has stuck around
on your shirt.
And it's now become, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it like Sam Fox.
That's right.
Isn't that right?
That's right. Stands for excellence, perfection, dedication,
experience, leadership.
Every one of those airmen, they're in the wing, in the PAG, and at the 89th, stand for Sam Fox Excellence, and that's known around the world, Sam Fox. And so when we greet each other, we don't say hello, we say goodbye, we say Sam Fox.
It's just a level of excellence to be a part of it, especially for me, for 50 years now, and running the Heritage Program. I've done a number of oral interviews. We've got about 75 hours of oral interviews from the flight engineer at Dallas, the hot cuppers at Dallas. The first active duty Army Air Force pilot, a young 22-year-old second lieutenant. He gave us about 3 hours flying Mrs. Roosevelt, and he was the initial crew on the Sacred Cow. So Sam Fox is alive. We've got a reunion coming up here in the fall. So it's just something we're kind of proud of.
That's wonderful. Now, Chris Henry tells me we have some great questions. I just want to make a comment and ask the general a question real quick, and then we can entertain the questions from the audience. The first thing was to mention with Sam Fox, it's wonderful. If you go into Sam 26000, the plane that flew Kennedy, you'll see that actually the Sam Fox logo is in the airplane. So it's this red-faced fox. It's awesome. So if you go there, look for that. And then a question I want to ask the general. So when you were the commander of the 89th, is there a moment or an event that was particularly special for you that you can remember while you were there? Anything that really stood out?
Well, it's always special the first time you meet the president. As the 89th Airlift Wing commander, Unlike the pilot who's watching the president from the third floor up from the 747 window looking down, you're at the base of the staircase. You walk the president from the helicopter to the base of the staircase as he ascends up. And the first time you do that, it's really special, right? Because you now feel part of the team. You know, you've done the training, you're part of the team, and you make the walk of the president. And they always ask you, so what did he say? What do you guys talk about? And they've always briefed you, don't talk about politics. You can talk sports. Here's the only kind of sports you can talk about, But sure enough, you can see it on their face. They maybe didn't have a great day, and they want to talk about something. Whatever they want to talk about, I'm ready to talk about. And so just having a little bit of time with the president, it was just so special to me and my family.
And what an amazing experience. So I understand, Chris, you have some great questions for us.
Absolutely. There are some wonderful questions coming in. And thank you to everybody on the panel. This has been fantastic. The first question is for the general. As someone who's just starting their Air Force career, what is the biggest piece of advice you could give them as they would like to one day fly Air Force One?
Well, I won't speak to the PAG and to the qualifications, but let me just tell you, do your very best in the job that you're in. Remember, you don't have to be, and to support the president, you don't have to just fly the airplane, right? There's lots of great airmen that support every aspect of this mission. It's just as important. And now, entering the Air Force, you're part of a great team, an amazing team of airmen who get after air power every day. So I'd say do your very best, right? And when the opportunity comes to you, take that step. Make the step. You can do it, right? And so don't shy away from challenges, because when you're challenged, you're growing. And so strive to grow.
Another question for the general. Is that a tradition that every commander of the 89th gets to meet the president?
Yes, so every commander of the 89th, managing all the rest of the logistics beyond the actual Air Force One aircraft and crew, it is tradition that the wing commander does escort the president when he gets off the airplane and onto the helicopter, and vice versa. So it's an awesome opportunity. It is afforded to a few other people, but mainly to the wing commander.
A question for the entire panel, for those retired or those still serving, actually. Do all of you or any of you fly general aviation or enjoy aviation as a hobby?
Yes, I'm glider owner and glider pilot.
I putz around with these warbirds at the other end. There's a B-25 named Panchito, and I get to fly and crew on that. I'm part of the B-17 crew here at Oshkosh, also the B-25, Berlin Express. Catch a ride when I can, but back home in Maryland at Two Whiskey Five, we have a little 172, 150s. But once you start flying, it's kind of hard to give it up.
Yeah, my husband and I have a Cessna 175. It's a 1958 straight tail classic. Had it for just over 20 years. And I grew up in general aviation. I was an instructor about 1,000 hours before I came into the military. So this kind of scenario, actually from Florida, sun and fun was more of my venue at the time, but I do love coming to Oshkosh.
Mm-hmm. Good recovery.
Just so everybody knows, Mark was just retired from Southwest Airlines as a captain. So he now he's a glider pilot, but he was a Southwest Airlines guy. I'm a general aviation pilot over at Amway across the lake in Grand Rapids. So Freighter 600, Global guy, et cetera. So you can't give up flying. It's too easy a job to get paid for. So I love it to death.
I fly just vicariously through Harry Fenton's Facebook posts.
Are the aircraft that fly the president maintained in a different manner than the rest of the line aircraft?
General?
I think this is.
Do you mean that I prioritize the resources for the beautiful blue and white 747? The answer is yes. But frankly, we have amazing maintainers that take care of all of our aircraft to the highest standards. But I would say that the The visuals on the 747 are probably the best. They spent a lot of time shining the airplane and making sure, you know, every screw is good to go. So I would say they hit the top of the rung.
One thing the general mentioned earlier was that Air Force One hires out of the rest of the wing. Well, that includes the maintenance guys, because the maintenance guys learn on the other aircraft in the wing that if you drop a wrench on a wooden table, you've just created a lot more work for yourself to fix the dent. So, the maintenance on the aircraft, all of the aircraft in the wing, is amazing.
I'd like to interject, too. That goes beyond the active airplanes. I've got an amazing story. I think Dr. Lantry can talk about what the 89th does to preserve its own history and maintain the historic aircraft.
Right. The maintenance of those airplanes goes well beyond the service life of the airplane. We've got 10 airplanes in the Air Force's National Museum that are associated with presidential and VIP transport. And just last week, the Presidential Airlift Group showed up, as they do regularly, to polish the airplane in the gallery. They polished one side of SAM 26000 one night after the museum closed, and they polished the other side the following night. This is a regular occurrence, and that is how you SAM Fox the preservation of the world's, I guarantee you, the cleanest, shiniest, most well-preserved airplanes in any gallery anywhere are the presidential aircraft in the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force. And it's because the PAG, the Presidential Airlift Group, shows up again and again because they want to SAM Fox it till the end of time. And we welcome them. Come on in and clean these big airplanes.
If I could add on to that. Yeah. Back in, I think it was 98, then I think Tech Sergeant Dave Sheff toured the Air Force Museum and saw the presidential fleet was not looking up to our standards. And he arranged for a bunch of the maintenance guys to go to Dayton on leave and polish aircraft, something that they do for their regular job. And we were able to work with the museum to put them on TDY orders, permissive TDY orders, so they didn't have to burn leave in order to do that, and we were able to arrange transportation and rooms out there for them. But they've been doing that since the late 90s.
And it's a great thing because when an aircraft comes out of the active inventory, there's some things that change. It is still an airplane, but it is also an artifact. And so preservation becomes the norm as opposed to maintenance. It's no longer a tool that's maintained, it's an artifact that is preserved. And so the skills of people who clean the airplanes and maintain them and so on are adjusted slightly in a museum gallery to the intention of preserving this thing as it is, as it was, for hundreds and hundreds of years, for following generations. So it's a little bit of a change of intent, but it is exactly the same enthusiasm and the same care that is put in to the work that they do. So we really appreciate the PAG coming along and helping maintain those aircraft. We feel like it maintains a living connection to Air Force heritage right in the gallery.
Jeff, one other thing. What they're talking about is our maintenance personnel, our flying crew chiefs are the top, they're the best. We had to give you an example of how dedicated they are, in the late 80s, President Reagan was gonna go to Iceland and he was gonna meet Mr. Gorbachev. And we were on a trip on a 137, a 707, and we were going to take the Secretary of State out, and he was going to be the advance lead, and they were going to set up the itinerary, and they were going to set up everything that had to be done. So they rolled that airplane into the hangar 5 days before we were scheduled to leave, and they polished, and they polished. And polishing was a two-headed buffer with a really good polishing agent. And all of that, what you see on TV, all that silver metal, then they put glass wax on it, and they buff the glass wax. And they buff it with balls of raw cotton with Pillsbury flour. And you put the flour on the cotton, you put it on the buffer, and you shine that metal. It's got glass wax, it's got metal polish, and it just absolutely is gorgeous. When we got to Reykjavik, the weather was not the best. And the next morning they had to de-ice the airplane. You got it. Our crew chief went up and actually started to cry all those hours with his whole crew, and there it went, right on down with the glycol. So our people maintaining these airplanes and going to Wright Pat to carry on, there's some fabulous people.
Yeah, we really do appreciate that attention to detail. And if you want to see some shiny metal, you come on down to Dayton.
You are going to see. National Museum of the Air Force. What a treasure.
One of the questions that we got, speaking of the National Museum of the United States Air Force, it's a two-part question. One, will you eventually get one of the 747s? And two, how long will that take to polish?
We had a conversation about this before we started. I talked to our director before I came up here because I knew that this question was coming. So the answer is in three parts. One, yes. Two, yes. And three, yes. But really, we're on the list. We have a marker on a VC-25A when it comes out of the inventory. When? Well, if you read the news recently, you'll find that we don't expect a VC-25A to be available before about 2028. Where will we put it? Well, our most recent 270,000 square foot building, the fourth one, is the current home of the Presidential Gallery, and with some reconfiguration, or three-dimensional chess as we call it, the airplane will fit in there. And so we look forward to having a VC-25A. When one is available, we have a spot for it. Things will have to move, but that's what we do. That can happen. Jeff can tell you about planning things like that.
Yeah, I was just saying to the group, the museum has 1/72 scale models of everything in the museum and 1/72 scale models of the buildings. And we had been working with those models for years, and the C-141 was the big model. And then the 1/72 scale model of a VC-25 came in, and it's in this huge crate. And we opened it up, yeah. And it just was ridiculous. So, but it will fit. And there's some amazing restoration technicians at the National Museum of the Air Force. They move all the aircraft, they hang them, they restore them. They're absolutely brilliant and talented. And you know, I have 100% confidence they'll be able to shoehorn a VC-25 in there, say, and protect the object.
I'm sure
there are
people who like to build models in this audience, right? I'm sure of it, yes. If you ever happen to see our 1/72 scale planning models, you'll be impressed, because it's 19 acres represented in 1/72 scale, and when you have to plan a gallery, you reach in like the hand of God through the roof, and you can move stuff around to make sure that this is going to be feasible in reality. And that's exactly what Jeff and some other people have done to figure out how to fit a VC-25A in amongst everything else and make all that three-dimensional chess work.
Yeah, I don't know why the guys in restoration complain. It's super easy to move the models. I don't see why it's so difficult to move
the real thing.
But
deal,
you know,
come on.
They just make it happen.
Yeah, just make it happen.
Two final questions. I lied, so I'm adding a question here briefly. Are the presidential aircraft, like Air Force One, ever allowed to fly with something like an MEL like we would in general aviation?
No, it's always perfect. Yeah, as you say, the plane's always perfect. I mean, to give you an example, every time we land, you're met by an engine guy, you know, avionics, et cetera, and they run over everything that has occurred during the flight, and they fix it. So if the the RPM's off by 0.5% the next time you fly it the next day or whatever. It's already been adjusted. Everything, yeah, I'm telling you, everything is perfect on those jets. It's the United States Air Force though. So MEL-able, et cetera, it's totally up to maintenance. Maintenance has their requirements from the United States Air Force. But I'm telling you now, if there's a drip that's coming off of the plane and it's acceptable per the 747 guide, it gets fixed immediately. We don't fly with a drip, or a seat, you name it, we don't fly with it. And the reason being is the president needs to know, and Sam Fox, we've done everything perfect. There's zero failure. We'll make sure that no issues do occur. So no, there's no MEL-able items that we would take.
And last question for me, then I'm going to hand it back to you, Jeff, is how did it feel that first day when you walked out and you realized you were an Air Force One pilot, you were going to fly the president on Navy One, or you were overseeing the 89th? What was that first moment, did it ever, any moment that came to you that said, oh my gosh, this is happening?
Go ahead.
I kind of already described when I was really nervous. I remember also waking up about 2 o'clock in the morning for the flight, and I turn on the news, and one of the pundits gets on there and says, hey, the president's flying out to the carrier today. I wonder who the pilot is. What if he crashes? The leader of the free world, you know? And so I turned that right off, not feeling too good about being selected to be the president's pilot at that moment. But afterwards, I think, you know, once I had landed, I mean, once it was over and you could breathe a sigh of relief, it felt pretty good.
I never felt uncomfortable about it all that much. It was what I'd been trained to do. And the first time I flew the president, I was co-pilot on a Gulfstream, C-20 Gulfstream G3. And it was a last minute deal. I had just flown the airplane in to Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, Alabama. And we were gonna take the president to Hagerstown, Maryland. And I moved from the left seat over to the right seat because now I'm gonna be the co-pilot. And my boss sticks his head in and says, hey, Mark, just do everything like you normally do on these Gulfstream flights. So I got the box programmed, the INS, and got clearances in there. I got everything ready. And I did this, and I realized since I'd been up preparing for this backup mission that I was on for like 14 hours, I had stubble. So I had this little battery-operated razor in my bag, and I pulled that out, and I started to shave the left side of my face, and I kind of glanced over my shoulder, and there's the TV cameras out there shining into the cockpit. I said, ooh, learned something new today, and I leaned back behind the bulkhead and finished.
Now, my first trip on Air Force One, Mark let me fly President Clinton to Akron, Ohio, so it was my first time in the left seat at 747. It was an uneventful trip, land Akron, Ohio. I think it's like a 7,000-foot runway or something. Turn off at the ends. We turn down the taxiways. I look out to the side, and the wing is going over the top of these Cessna 172s that are all parked. But they thought they were far enough away, but in reality, they were not. So literally, they hadn't been moved far enough away. So the thought is, okay, do I get really close and put the wing over the top of the Cessnas? Of course you do. So the wing came right over the top of the Cessnas, pulled into parking, nothing to it. Then eventually the FBO that had all the Cessnas came in and said, hey, you know how damn close you were to those Cessnas? Not a clue, but it doesn't matter because it didn't. The press didn't see it, no one saw it, and you're the first ones to ever hear about it. So, but it was a great trip. I was very happy to have survived. So.
And Chuck, what about your first day on the job?
There's a young lady in the front row. About 4 weeks before she was born, I got to take President Carter out to Denver for a political speech. And as I said, we planned. When I stepped on board that morning, it was just, wow, I'm on Air Force One. And then you just do your job, because somebody behind me gave me a quick little nudge and said, hey, you're holding up the show. One of the memorable things was after Denver, we stopped in Minneapolis and we picked up Senator Hubert Humphrey. And he died about 3 days later. We had brought him back to D.C. and as a guest of President Carter. And he went into Walter Reed and, well, he passed a couple of days later. So it was quite a trip.
Yeah, ma'am, I think it'd be a great way to close if you tell us about your first day on the job.
Yeah, I'm just going to echo what Mark and Mark both said. You know, Air Force One leads. My first day on the job, I was amazed at the quality of airmen and civilians who manage this no-fail mission every day. Everybody, with every instance, jumped to solve problems to ensure that we could execute a no-fail mission at any time. And there was just no hesitancy, no doubt, and they were very proud of what they did, from ensuring that even when the first taxi up or first pull up of the aircraft, if there was just a little leak or a little spot, they would jump out and clean it so that the picture for the DB, whether it be the president or the secretary of state walking up, was perfect. That the red carpet, if it had two pieces of dirt on it, someone would run out with a little, battery-powered vacuum and vacuum it up immediately. And there was no asking. It just happened. It just happens. And when that kind of stuff happens all around you, when people who really care and have a passion for what they're doing, it is magic.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So everybody, please join me in thanks for the time that these wonderful people spent with us. And thanks again for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your week here at AirVenture.